Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. My guest today is Dr. Dee Boersma, an esteemed professor at the University of Washington who has been working with and studying Galapagos penguins for some 40 years. Dr. Boersma just returned from most recent sojourn to the Galapagos about 2 weeks ago. So armed with new information from that trip that we'll hear about when we speak with her presently. Also, later in the show, we'll have a brief chat with Ted Coran, who, along with his wife Karen, operate the Critter Place Animal Sanctuary in Weekiwachi. We spoke with Ted last summer when they were facing some struggles. Ted had been laid off from his job. Karen was battling ovarian cancer. We'll get an update from Ted on how things are going now. Also, Name That Animal Tune, we'll be giving away the debut CD by Wild Flag, the band Carrie Brownstein plays in when she's not working on Portlandia. Right now, though, let's talk penguins. With a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Dr. Dee Boersma back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Dr. Boersma.
Well, good morning, Duncan.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been many, many years since we last spoke on the show, and so I feel like we have all the more to discuss, given that period. So, as I noted a moment ago, you've been studying and working with Galapagos penguins for some 40 years, and just returned from your most recent trip there. So, I'm excited to hear the new information you gleaned on that trip. But I think it might be useful to sort of first develop a sense of history and context a bit. So, starting with back all those years, many years ago, what first drew you to penguins?
Well, I guess I was first drawn to the Galapagos, and then I got drawn to penguins.
I see.
Thought it was so peculiar that a penguin could live on the equator.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I think most people sort of associate penguins with cold climates, Antarctica, for example, or they're in ice.
That's right. But there's 18 species of penguins, and many of them are really temperate species of penguins. And, of course, the most northerly is the Galapagos penguins that lives right on that equator. But you don't think that penguins should be able to live on the equator. And so I guess that's what first really drew me to Galapagos penguins. And then once you see a penguin, you can't help but think that they're unusual and fall in love with them. Or at least for me, that's
right.
What happened.
So once you got to the Galapagos, so I guess since I got it in slightly reverse order, what drew you to the Galapagos? And then from there, you got drawn to the penguins.
Well, I just found the theory of evolution in Charles Darwin's Beagle Journey pretty incredible. And then I started reading a little bit about it, I guess actually in high school. And there was a guy that named Ibel Ibelsfeld who'd worked on a German and worked on marine iguanas. And that's the only marine-going lizard. I mean, it feeds on algae in the Galapagos. And I thought that was pretty weird. So
yeah.
It just seemed to me that there were so many unusual things in the Galapagos, and how could they get there, and how could they live there, and it's the cradle of evolution, and so that's what really drew me to the Galapagos.
I see. So once you got there, I guess because you're a biologist and your PhD is in zoology, so the fact that here were these sort of singular, it sounds like, situations with these animals, that just seemed like the place to be.
Well, I think the other thing is one of the things when you get a PhD, they tell you you have to discover something new.
I see. And, the pressure's on, Dr. Boersma.
Sure,
yeah. You mean you felt once you got there, you were just bound to.
Well, I knew I was interested in penguins, and I just thought that was the perfect thing. I mean, there'd been, I think, 3 nests of Galapagos penguins that had ever been discovered. So there was really very little known.
I see. So, yeah, you really felt like, hey, I'm right here on the forefront where my PhD advisors told me I should be.
Right.
Yeah. Well, great. This is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, my guest is Dr. Dee Boersma, a professor at the University of Washington, who has been studying Galapagos penguins, as we're hearing now, for some 40 years, and just returned from the Galapagos 2 weeks ago. If you'd like to ask Dr. Boersma a penguin question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So once you got to the Galapagos, and once you said, "Hey, wow, these Galapagos penguins are pretty enchanting." How long after that did your actual study or the penguin project begin?
Well, the penguin project really is a little broader than just Galapagos penguins. We've been working on Magellanic penguins in Argentina for 30 years.
Yeah.
So we're particularly interested in penguins as sentinels of environmental change. But they're really sentinels of the environment, not only the ocean, but the land. So they can tell us a lot about how we're misusing or using the oceans correctly.
And so I was going to get into that in a moment, but here we are now. So how so? I mean, because one of the things that's obviously so interesting about your study, and it truly is obviously a classic sort of long-term study, is that it's a lot more than just about the penguins that you're looking at. It's the implications of what you've found for the environment, for the climate, and really studying them for that long. So what are some of the important things that over those many years now that have emerged in terms of the key implications of that?
Well, I guess one of the things that started me on this was people wanting to harvest penguins and turn them into high fashion gloves and protein and oil. And I just thought, Jesus, there's a lot of things we can do, but we don't have to kill penguins to do that. And so that's what got me started in Argentina. And once I got down to Argentina, I started walking some of these beaches, and there are all these oiled penguins that are dead on the beaches. And then you realize, well, if they're running into oil, and it's not like there's just oil in the environment. It's like we're dumping oil into the ocean. Mm. Where's that coming from? And
yeah.
It turns out it's a lot cheaper to dump ballast water from tankers into the ocean than to treat it. And that was what was happening in the early 80s. And so literally thousands and thousands of Magellanic penguins were dying because they ran into this oil. So we moved the tanker lanes. I mean, I didn't do it, but the politics did it, and the penguins did it. So once you have information, I think people will often act responsibly, and it's not like you have to have one or the other. You can do development and use the environment, but still protect the wildlife.
Sure. So that sounds like that the discovery about the oil and the impact of the oil was fairly early on, if not even immediate from your description.
Yeah.
And
so you couldn't help but see it.
Right. But I guess what I'm wondering then is over the ensuing years, what sorts of other sort of notable discoveries or findings have you made in
Well, I guess that's one of the reasons why I've stuck with penguins for so long, because I do find it fascinating to be able to look at how they're adapted to their environment, but also what problems they're having because of human uses. Of course, now we've got 7 billion people in the world.
Yeah.
That's twice as many as in the 60s. So there's a lot more people, and there's a lot less penguins. And so one of my interest is, can't we balance people with penguins a little better than we have? So I saw not only oiled penguins, but what we've been doing with our satellite tagging and things like that is that we're looking at how far do penguins have to go to find their food. And they're going, in general, farther now than they did a decade ago. So that's climate change, really.
Yeah.
And then other places you look, and penguins have trouble finding food after a fishing boat goes, through a bay and kind of hoovers up the fish off of South Africa. So African penguins are having trouble finding food because, of course, we're taking more and more small fish out of the ocean, and that's penguin food.
Yeah.
So no matter where you kind of look, and the Galapagos are really, as I said, right on the equator, and they're affected a lot by these El Nino events. And we know that El Nino events have gotten more frequent, and so climate change affects Galapagos penguins. And what it means for Galapagos penguins is that sometimes when the waters are cold and upwelling, there's a lot of nutrients and food's no problem. But when the waters get warm and there's not upwelling and nutrients, there's no food. And so it's really tough for a penguin that forages on small fish. So part of the time when there's La Nina, they got big schools of fish. And when there's El Nino, there are no big schools of fish. They have to turn to eating things like small reef fish to make it through. And many of them don't. So
many of them don't because they're not able to adapt to what's required.
They can't find the food.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, if most of the small fish are gone, penguins can't really eat anything bigger than their head, although they'll try. And so it's hard for them to eat the reef fish that are around. I mean, usually you never see a penguin manipulate their food above the water. They eat it all underwater. But during these El Nino events, you'll see them actually trying to eat reef fish, and they'll be manipulating them above the water because they're just a little too big, so it's hard for them to get them in the right position to swallow them down.
And so, Dr. Boersma, I mean, to what extent do these sorts of things that sound pretty pretty significant, obviously, for these penguins, I mean, to what extent do the findings, because this is all so far, everything you've said almost seems very much rooted in climate change. So to what extent does the study and the project work the other way in terms of like, well, this is what we're seeing that happens to the penguins. What can we learn or take from that that would help us go back on the human end of that path? Or is it just, hey, the climate change is what it is. As you said before, there's twice as many humans as there were earlier, and this is kind of our lot? Or are there actual practical applications that might help us in some way that the sort of plight you've described these penguins can help with?
Well, that's what really drove me back to the Galapagos, is thinking about what I first saw there when I was doing my PhD. And I realized I saw a pair of penguins that laid eggs out in the open, you know, just like they were a daily penguin or something that was living in Antarctica.
Yeah.
Antarctica. They just laid their eggs right on the black lava. And what happened when I watched that pair is that, they'd incubate their eggs, all night and first thing in the morning. And by about 9 o'clock, they were panting like a dog. They were so hot. Mm. And so they'd desert their eggs and go to the sea. And then about 4 o'clock when it got cooler, bang, they were back incubating their eggs. Well, needless to say, those eggs died. I mean, it was way too hot, and they fried the eggs.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So I thought, I wonder if there's something that we can do for, you know, penguins. Maybe they don't have enough nests. And, of course, lots of birds that don't have enough nests. We put out birdhouses, you know, by our houses to attract chickadees and wrens and things like that. Why not build condos for penguins? And I thought, you know, maybe they just don't have enough nests, and we can build them really shady nest sites. And then whenever there's good food available, they can breed. And so that's why 40 years later I ended up back in the Galapagos, to see if we could really build the Galapagos penguin population, which has declined because of this increased frequency of El Nino since the 1970s.
So it sounds like by the actual intervention of you and your colleagues, specifically helping with those nests, that has kind of reversed the population decline.
Well, I'd like to say that it's reversed it, but we haven't really had a good test of our experiment. We've built 120 nests, and I came back less than 2 weeks ago, and what I found when I was down there is we searched high and low, and we found 13 active nests, and I was so thrilled because 8 of those active nests were natural nests, ones that I'd seen 40 years ago.
Okay.
But 5 of them had moved into the condos that we had built.
Wow.
And 2 of them moved in since the nests were built in February of 2013. So in less than 6 months, 2 pairs of penguins moved in and laid eggs. So that was that was really rewarding.
So it's working. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
I'm waiting for a really big event where there's lots of cold water and all the penguins want to breed.
Right. But so I guess just to kind of extrapolate a little bit from there. So when you go next year, which you apparently inevitably will there be more nests that you and others will try to build there to see if those numbers can be expanded, or what do you think the next step from what you found on this most recent visit would be?
Well, we are learning more about what kind of nests the penguins really like. Of course, they like the ones that are the hardest to build, in my view, which means that we have to dig them into the lava.
Mm.
So that's really well, it's hard work with a chisel or something else to make a hole in the lava. But those are the ones that they seem to like the most.
Because they're most protected, or?
Pardon me?
Because they're most protected there, or what?
I think there's the most shade.
Okay.
Yeah, they're protected. There's plenty of shade in there, and it's cool. And that's what they want.
Yeah.
And so if I build them like little carports, that's all right. But I think they don't really like those as well. So they pick these hard ones first.
Wow. Okay. Well, they have their demands, but you seem to be meeting them. So Dr. Borsum, I mean, in a way, you've partially answered this question, I guess. But when you go each year, I mean, first of all, how long do you stay on any annual visit?
Well, the problem with many of these studies, and particularly in the Galapagos, to be able to go and see the Galapagos penguins, you have to go about 2 days on a boat to the western part of the archipelago.
Mm.
So it's a long commute.
Yeah.
Once you get there, yeah, there's lots of penguins, but boats are expensive.
Sure.
So all of this sort of stuff is just really tough to do in terms of you need to do it as quickly as possible because you want to keep the expenses down. You got to go a long way. But when you finally get there, there are, you know, lots of penguins. Galapagos penguins are the rarest of all penguins. Nevertheless, there's probably between 1,800 and, I don't know, 4,200 Galapagos penguins. So we don't know exactly how big the population is, but we do know that they're mostly over on the western archipelago, and that's where we've been concentrating some of our nest building.
And is there sort of an optimal time that for you to make this trek, given what's involved in getting there?
Well, we try to go twice a year, and the best time to go, of course, is when the water temperatures are cool, indicating that there's lots of upwelling, so lots of penguins should be breeding.
Yeah.
The problem has been, since we built the nest in 2010, we haven't had really good cold upwelling water, so there hasn't been a lot of nutrients, and there hasn't been a lot of breeding.
Ah. Wow.
So we have to wait for our experiment to run. That's
right.
One of the challenges.
So many variables.
I wish I could know exactly when.
Yeah. There may not be a typical day then when you're there, but sort of walk us through a given day there. Obviously, there's nest building, at least on some of those days. But like, when do you start your day? What do you do most often as any given day as part of that project?
Well, now we've built 120 of these lava condos. In the rocker, building these carports, and we check all those nests. So we have to go to the place, check the nests. But the other thing that we're doing is checking the penguins. So that's like you going to the doctor. I mean, the first thing that happens for most people when they go to the doctor is they weigh you. We do the same thing with penguins. We want to know how healthy they are. And weight tells you a lot about an individual person as well as an individual penguin.
Sure.
So penguins can be fat or skinny, just like people. And so by weighing them, you get some sort of sense of their body condition. You know, how well are they doing? And what we've seen in so many of these trips since 2010 is the penguins are in poor body condition. They're below what would be the zero line. You know, I mean, people that we say, oh, you don't have any body fat. You are really in good condition. Well, penguins are below that in many cases. They're surviving. They're all right. But they're not in good condition, and if they're not in good condition, they can't breed.
And does that go back to what you were describing before about the difficulty, climate, you know, change-based thing of the extra effort that's required, expended to get their food and get back to where they need to be, and are those all just sort of a sequence of events then?
Yes, and the other thing that's interesting about Galapagos penguins is where they live in the Galapagos, they've had to adapt, and they're very different from other penguins. Most other species, in fact, all other species of penguins, molt once a year. Molting means that they drop all their feathers and grow new ones. So imagine a bad-looking sleeping bag. That's what they look like. They push out all of their old feathers, and they grow new ones. Well, when they're growing new feathers, it's just like a sleeping bag. You got, like, holes in it. And so for the penguin, because they're not well insulated with their feathers now, they have to stand out on shore, because if they were in the water, they'd get cold. It's like having a hole in your wetsuit. So during that time when they're molting, they're standing on shore, and they're losing weight and growing new feathers. So penguins go through this feast and famine. So they build up a lot of fat, and then they can molt their feathers, and then they lose because they're standing around. Well, I guess you could think of it as people after Thanksgiving and Christmas and the first of the new year, where we tend to eat a lot. So many of us gain several pounds over that time.
Sure.
Well, what penguins do is they just stand on shore and lose it all because they fast. So they're going through this yo-yo dieting, I suppose, several times a year. So they molt their feathers twice a year because they live on the tropics. It's really hot, and it's got lots of algae there that can grow on their feathers. So they molt them twice. That's costly. What makes Galapagos penguins unique is they tend to molt before they breed. So they take care of themselves before they try to reproduce.
Mm.
And if they didn't do that, they'd likely die.
Right. Right. So again, but if they're doing it that way and they're conserving their energy, et cetera, then they're going to be less inclined to mate, and there'll be fewer chicks.
Wait around until the conditions get right.
Wow.
And then when the conditions are right, then everybody should go. And so our idea about these houses is, hey, when conditions are right, let's make it possible so every penguin that wants to can breed, because that will build up the population really quickly. Now, the next El Nino comes by, many of them will die. But because everybody got to breed when they want to, some of those are going to learn how to forage, and even though there's not very much food, they're still going to be able to get through that.
Yeah.
So we want to help build the population quickly after these events that are so stressful and can cause mortality in there for the adults as well as their young.
Right. So it really sounds like to reduce it down, I mean, building these condos is really helping at one point or another to build the population.
Yep, that's what we hope.
Yeah.
I mean, the jury is still out, but I look at it and go, geez, there's 8 pairs that were able to lay eggs and raise chicks that wouldn't have if we hadn't built these condos.
Yeah. So far, so good.
So far, so good.
You're right. So this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Dr. Dee Boersma, professor at the University of Washington, who has been studying Galapagos penguins for some 40 years. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. So we do have some questions from listeners, Dr. Boersma. One is I was curious about whether your guest has encountered too many tourists visiting the Galapagos Islands. I am concerned that the popularity of the islands as a tourist spot could harm the penguins and other animals.
Oh, yeah. Tourism is always a problem. We try to be responsible, and certainly the Galapagos is one of the more carefully regulated tourist attractions in the world because everybody goes with a trained guide. You can't have any more than 15 in the group. But still, the problem everywhere is we're homogenizing the world. So it's the tourists that have really brought in, as well as the people living in the Galapagos, but particularly the demands of tourism that have brought in so many invasive species. People live in the Galapagos. I mean, we think of, well, there's nobody that lives there. Well, yeah, there have been people there since before Charles Darwin visited.
Yeah.
And now there's about 40,000 people that live in the Galapagos.
Wow.
When I started there 40 years ago, it was something more like 10,000. So it's growing very, very rapidly, and of course people eat, and they want to have the same sort of lifestyle that we have in the U.S. or any place else. So 40 years ago, on one of the islands, Santa Cruz, I think there were 4 Jeeps. Well, there's thousands of cars now.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and there are roads. So things change, and people bring those changes, and with them they bring things like blackberries that are an invasive species, and in some areas are covering much of the native vegetation. They bring things like yellow paper wasps that never were in the islands. And so now you've got paper wasps and stuff all over, and they're eating other little native insects. And so we change the environment.
Wow. So it's really like almost like kind of a microcosm there of the sort of environmental change and climate change issues that we were talking about a moment ago more broadly that are happening right there on the Galapagos.
That's right. And if we can't, you know, if we can't protect the Galapagos, where in the world are we really going to be able to protect it?
Yeah.
And of course, a few years ago, the Galapagos was put on the endangered World Heritage Site, because the Galapagos is a World Heritage Site. And they said, you know, there's just not enough happening to protect it. It's now been taken off the endangered World Heritage Site. I'm not exactly convinced that that's probably the correct decision, but at least there was attention brought to the problems there. But how we're going to be able to manage these many of these things is unclear. So many airplanes go in every day. What do the airplanes bring with them? Well, they can bring in mosquitoes. Why do we need to worry about mosquitoes? Well, they bring malaria. They bring West Nile virus. West Nile virus is likely to be very susceptible to many of the birds in the islands, not only penguins, but Darwin's finches. Mm. So we could see a lot of incredible changes because of the diseases that we bring into the islands, as well as many of these invasive species.
Wow. So many factors, so many variables that, that's a lot to take in. Well, here's another email question, which I think we probably would at this point view as a rhetorical question, but it says, great guess. Penguins come in such different shapes and sizes. Do you have a favorite species? I'm going to guess I know the answer to this, but I could be wrong.
Well, it's hard to have a favorite, but of course the ones that you spend the most time with end up being your favorite ones.
Sure.
I must say, I really do enjoy all species of penguins, but I have one favorite penguin that lives in Argentina. And that bird, for whatever reason, we've never fed him or anything else, but he is a single male, and he spends a lot of time hanging around us since he doesn't have a female. Hmm. And we've called him Turbo because he started out hanging out under our Turbo truck. But I suppose Magellanic penguins are still my favorite.
And I was going to ask this, but this sort of brings up another question I was going to ask is that, you know, having this kind of, you know, the sort of ultimate long-term study and going every year, it sounds like maybe, you know, twice a year from what you mentioned earlier. I mean, you know, I was wondering to what extent you find yourself feeling an emotional attachment to some of these penguins and in some cases, you know, Turbo maybe answers this as well. Do they typically get names or only in a special case like that?
Oh, ones that we see a lot, of course, we end up naming. And you can tell who they are not only by their band number in the case of this Magellanic penguin, but by their behavior. I mean, Turbo, he's an unusual penguin. I've been down on the beach looking for banded penguins, and one of my graduate students looked up and said, there's a banded penguin walking towards us. And I said, oh, no, it's Turbo. And sure enough, it was. Turbo walked over, greeted us like he would another penguin, and then, you know, walked off back to his nest site. We were probably a kilometer from where he lived.
Hmm.
But he saw us and came over and greeted us like he would a penguin. Some of those sorts of experiences, for me, have been incredibly moving.
Yeah.
You know, we have those experiences sometimes with our dogs and our cats because we're sharing life with them on a daily basis. But to have some of those experiences with penguins, I found extremely moving. And hence, I guess, the reason that I've spent so much time seeing if I could at least make their lives a little better.
Yeah, well, you know, Dr. Borsma, I mean, people that don't have anywhere near the kind of exposure that you do to penguins seem to love penguins. I mean, just response to my little blurbs and Facebook posts and other stuff for this morning's show alone seems to attest to that. But other indications, I mean, that documentary a few years back, the March of the Penguins was enormously popular. I mean, this seems like people really respond to penguins. I mean, what accounts for this in your view? Has that been true for many, many decades, or has there been a shift in your experience over time in that way?
Well, I think one is that we have more information on penguins, and
okay.
I don't think you can really, you know, treasure or love things until you at least have some understanding of their biology.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of these studies, like the French that resulted in March of the Penguins, that filming, none of us would really want to spend the winter in Antarctica under those sorts of torrential cold winds and ice conditions. But the emperor penguins can, you know, incubate their eggs at minus 40 degrees and still survive. So we find that amazing and incredible.
Yeah.
And I think animals are amazing and incredible. Unfortunately, we don't spend enough time really understanding our natural world. And that's, one of my laments. And so, fortunately for me, people like the Wildlife Conservation Society have helped fund my work and many individuals. And so we send out a newsletter a couple times a year. So if people are interested in learning more about penguins, they can go to www.penguinsentinels.org or penguinstudies.org, and they'll learn more about penguins than they probably want to know.
Well, no, I don't know if that's even true or if that's even possible. But along those lines, excuse me. I mean, what is a fact or maybe two about penguins that most of us would find really surprising?
Okay, they can swim faster than Michael Phelps. So a wow. penguin can go 176 kilometers in a day, and so that's over 100 swimming 100 miles a day. And they can swim the same speed day and night and do, because we know this from putting satellite tags on the back of these penguins. So we know where they go, how fast they can forage, and they can do this for more than 24 hours. That I find amazing.
Yeah.
So they're amazing athletes. They can dive. Magellanic penguins go down to about 90 meters, but how big the penguin is really determines how far it can go down. So emperor penguins can hold their breath for more than 20 minutes.
Wow.
You and I can't do that.
No, they'll say. Yeah.
So they're just incredibly interesting creatures. And they live a long time. I mean, some of these penguins I banded at Punta Tombo in Argentina over 30 years ago, and they're still alive. So, they have long lives, too, and many of them are faithful. So they're not only monogamous, but some of them have stayed together for 16 years.
And yeah, that has been one of the things that's really kind of been distinctive about penguins. Am I right in thinking that one of the few things that would disrupt that is difficulty with mating, or maybe more to the point, difficulty raising or hatching a chick? Is that,
the penguins that probably have the highest divorce rates are emperor penguins, the ones that are found at the very extreme south of our world, and the most northerly, the Galapagos penguins. And the reason that their divorce rates are generally somewhat higher is because if you're a Galapagos penguin and your mate has not mated, and you are in good condition, ready to breed, you're going to breed with whoever comes. And the same thing's true for emperor penguins.
Yeah.
You got to breed with whoever's coming in and laying those eggs, because you're already fasting. So you got to get going.
Right. Right.
So sometimes you can't wait for whoever you mated with the year before.
And
so Galapagos penguins, they can lay eggs sometimes up to three times in a year, because the first clutch fails, the second one, the water temperatures get warmer, so, that fails. So they just keep trying.
Right.
And eventually they get it right.
Right. And so, again, once conditions are favorable, including a nice condo, et cetera, then they're off on their merry way with mating. So is there, because again, to a lot of us who don't know a fraction of what you do, obviously, about them, they seem just obviously fun, sort of charismatic, just nice animals. Is there a dark side of penguins?
Oh, yeah. You think of them as being cute and cuddly, but they are definitely not cute and cuddly. Even the little blue penguin, which only weighs about 1 kilo, so like a little over 2 pounds. You pick those up, and you look at them and think, oh, my goodness, it's like a wind-up toy. And as soon as you pick that up, and if you try to hug it close, it'll take a chunk out of your chin. It's a penguin.
Wow.
Those guys are feisty. But, of course, wouldn't you be feisty if a giant picked you up?
Yeah.
They defend themselves. But I've just, once you start to learn about these penguins, you see that they're not that different from people. They've got personalities. Some of them are a little more grumpy than other ones.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are very curious. Some of them are shy. So you see the same sort of range of behaviors from individual to individual. And that's what's kept me going. Because, of course, long-term studies are so difficult because there's not funding for them. What's allowed me to do this are really people that have been interested in penguins and have been interested in finding out more about them. So that's how we've done our satellite tagging. Individuals have said, okay, here's $5,000, name a penguin for me.
Yeah.
This is what I want it named. And we say, fine, whatever you want to name it, we'll name it and we'll follow it and tell you what happens to that penguin. And that's how we've gotten most of the information that we have, because of individuals caring enough about penguins to help us.
And Dr. Borsma, if someone listening who might not have $5,000 to contribute to the kitty, but wanted to support your work in one way or another, would they go to that penguinsentinels.org, or what would be the best place if they wanted to try to contribute to your efforts in this way?
If they wrote a check to the University of Washington, it's tax deductible to the Penguin Project, and so we would be happy to use that funding to learn more about penguins and to fund graduate students to be able to further their careers and their work studying penguins and to try to help with the conservation of all of these species of penguins around the world. Another place that is good to look is the Global Penguin Society, which is trying to help all the species of penguins around the globe.
Yeah. And we're just sort of in the last moment or so of our time, Dr. Boersma, but when you talked about part of the way those funds could be used would be grad students and others. I mean, how many other colleagues of one kind or another work with you when you are down there and making these annual or sometimes twice annual treks?
Well, when I'm working on Galapagos penguins, I work with a boat and the crew of that boat. And that's one of my colleagues that I've known for 40 years that lives in the Galapagos.
Wow.
And usually I take one other person with me, a scientist or student. And so it's a very small group because we're in pretty tight quarters for 10 days. I mean, this last time the water temperatures were cool. So it was tough to take those showers where you just dump buckets of water from the ocean on yourself. So it's kind of rugged in that sense.
Yeah.
And down at Punta Tombo in Argentina, I usually have at least two or three grad students, you know, with me down there.
That's great. And yeah, they obviously have a real commitment, it sounds like, to your work as well. So, Dr. Boersma, this has been really, really fun and fascinating, and I really appreciate you making the time. And again, you know, getting up extra early in the Washington, Seattle area to speak with us live today. And so again, we've been speaking with Dr. Dee Boersma, again, from the University of Washington. A couple different places to go to find out more or maybe support her work would be penguinsentinels.org. Global Penguin, that is .org as well,
yep.
Dr. Boersma?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. And just probably searching for, it's Boersma, Dr. Dee Boersma. You could search for that on the internet and or the Penguin Project and any number of ways you can find out more information or find out how you could help in one way or another. So thank you again for joining us today on Talking Animals and all your great work on our behalf of our nice penguin friends.
Well, thank you very much, Duncan, and thank you to all your listeners, and I hope we get some more people interested in penguins.
I'm sure we did that this morning. Thanks again. Take care now.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, in just a few minutes, we'll speak with Ted Coran from the Critter Place, the Animal Sanctuary in WikiWatcha. Right now, let's step in to the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is a Talking Animals favorite, Jim Gaffigan, with part of a piece called I'm a Manatee on today's Comedy Corner. I'm talking animals.
My favorite animal is the manatee, the sea cow. The manatee is endangered with extinction, and I think it's because it's out of shape. It looks like a retired football player. You ever see the manatee on the Discovery Channel? It's always floating around like, I'm bloated. Too much pizza for me. The manatee is also called the sea cow. Sea cow, that sounds like an insult. It's almost as if the manatee was introduced to the ocean, the other animals were like, who's the new guy? The manatee was like, oh, hi, everyone. You can call me the manatee. Yeah, right, sea cow.
Name's manatee.
Sea cow, fat ass.
quit it.
I'd love to see the manatee on a show like Ricky Lake. The manatee be sitting there like,
Ricky, I'm here because I'm endangered.
And then one of those mean people in the audience would offer up the advice, yeah, I want to say something to the sea pig. That sea cow, whatever. Sea pig, you a fat seal, you got to get yourself an education and a job. Man, he'd be like, I live in the ocean. Just so happen you live in the ocean because you ain't got no job. You got to get in Weight Watchers, some kind of program.
I have a layer of blubber to keep my body warm in the water.
Whatever, talk to the hand.
I don't have a hand.
What if a manatee was in the audience? They might laugh, but they'd be crying on the inside. It doesn't look like God tried that hard on the manatee, does it? He's a... All right, blunted flip-flops. What the hell? Let's go with a goatee. You know what? I got a golf game. Throw this around Florida. It'll fit in. Hey, I'm from Florida. I don't think God plays golf.
All right, that was Jim Gaffigan with part of a piece called I'm a Manatee, taken from his CD, Doing My Time. All right then, from the Critter Place, an animal sanctuary in Weekiwachi, let's welcome Ted Corman back to Talk Animals. Good morning, Ted.
Well, good morning there, Duncan.
How are you, sir?
Doing pretty good.
Good, good.
Out here watching my pork chop, wondering what I'm doing.
Okay. And I guess we should say, for those listening who might not know, pork chop, of course, is one of your fabulous pigs there at the sanctuary. So speaking of that, in fact, why don't, for those who may not have heard our conversation a year plus ago, maybe you could just give a quick description of the Critter Place.
We're a sanctuary for, obviously, roosters and potbelly pigs, feral pigs, a couple of horses, dogs and cats, a few stray birds have flown in all exhausted and pooped out from their flight, and so we took them in. We just kind of got a little bit of a menagerie around here.
And how many animals in total at the moment, would you say, Ted?
We're at about 66. Unfortunately, we lost a cat last week, so you take them in knowing that someday you're going to lose them.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Well, there's certainly a lot of animals that are benefiting from your care. Now, you know, when we did speak, I guess it was probably about June of last year, you and your wife Karen were sort of in a rough spot. You'd been laid off from your job. Karen was being treated for ovarian cancer. So I guess one of the things I sort of find out today is just, you know, how things are going at this point.
It's going. We get quite a bit of support from people and a lot of prayers and people give us well wishes. And, of course, we get donations here and there, which is helpful. And there's people out there that are very caring. There's even one really crazy attorney. I think he needs his head examined. He took our case in our foreclosure situation, and charging us next to nothing.
Well, Ted, maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because that's sort of one of the things that happened recently that I had heard about that prompted me to want to speak with you again briefly today. Is so you guys received a foreclosure notice at the sanctuary?
Yes, we've been kind of in the struggle for the last 3 years since the recession, and I've had 5 layoffs in 4 years, so we'll get caught up and then get caught up, and the paperwork finally got filed, and an attorney offered to give us an extremely discounted price. In fact, he called me up the other day and even lowered the amount, which is absolutely unheard of, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. And good for him, because obviously you guys need some help, and it sounds like you're getting it from him. And how is Karen doing at this point?
For everything that she's been through, she's doing amazingly well. Last year, she went through a full series of chemotherapy and then major surgery, and we thought it was in remission. And then this past 2 months ago, she went in for just a 3 month check, and her cancer had returned. Fortunately, it's still in the early stage, so she started a whole new regimen, different type of chemotherapy, and we were scared to death at first.
Yeah, of course.
She told us what the side effects could possibly be, and of course, that was 2-3 hours of just absolute terror, wondering when these symptoms are going to kick in. And amazingly enough, the only side effect she's having is fatigue. So she's able to get out and spend some time with the animals. Of course, that's half her therapeutic that keeps her busy, keeps her mind busy.
I'm sure.
Keeps her happy.
Right. And otherwise, am I right in thinking, Ted, that largely you look after all these animals pretty much single-handedly, apart from when, you know, Karen is able to help out?
No, Karen is able to help about half the time.
Okay.
I usually, one thing good about being laid off at the moment, is that I'm able to take care of the morning feedings, and that's usually the longest feeding.
Sure.
Is the morning, and then of course we have the noon and afternoon feedings and everything,
yeah.
All the other chores that are involved in between. So I try
sure.
to get the brunt of it.
But it's really just the two of you handling all this pretty much, right?
Yeah, we're pretty much out in the boondocks up at the very north end of Hernando County, just south of Homosassa. So it's difficult to find volunteers willing to come out here. We get some every once in a while, and we're always grateful.
Sure. Well, along those lines, Ted, we're probably just nearing the end of our time of our brief chat, but why don't you give us a website and maybe Facebook page information where people who were interested in helping out, if they could either send a few dollars, great, or sounds like if people were willing to make the trek out, you probably welcome some volunteer help, even if people couldn't necessarily send money at the moment.
No, they can even come out and just spend some time with the animals. I'm sure they'd enjoy that.
Sure.
And we do have a Facebook site. Just do a search, The Critter Place, or facebook.com/The Critter Place.
Okay.
That'll take it right through the site. And we have a non-Facebook page for those few people that aren't on Facebook. It's Weebly, Weebly.com. Slash The Critter Place.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's the opposite. TheCritterPlace.weebly.com. I'm sorry.
Right, okay. That's what I had thought. But okay, cool. So either TheCritterPlace.weebly, Weebly.com, or just on Facebook, either you can just search for it pretty easily at The Critter Place, and it pops right up. So there's places in either location for folks who would like to help out one way or another, send some money, or again, if they want to get in touch and see about coming to help out a little bit with some of the chores, or just visit with the animals. Sounds like you're open to all those possibilities.
Yeah, it'd be great to see people up here, and everybody always enjoys spending some time with our animals.
Great. All right, Ted. Well, good luck to you. You guys kind of keep plugging away under some obviously adverse circumstances, and so hopefully some people might be listening today that can help out one way or another. So hang in there and give my best to Karen, and take care.
If I could throw a quick one in, I'm trying to start a maintenance business called Ted's Maintenance Services. That's also on Facebook.
Under the Critter Place page, or a separate page?
It's a totally separate page. Trying to just start my own business because work is hard to find.
Sure.
So I'm getting a few clientele, doing some handyman and minor home repairs and maintenance and cleaning.
Great. All right. Well, good for you. Good luck with that as well.
Thank you so much.
All right, Ted. Thank you so much. Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye now. I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive the debut CD by Wild Flag. Carrie Brownstein's Post Leader Kenny Band. We'll do that in a moment or two here on Talking Animals. Right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements, starting with federal funds for a Nevada-based desert tortoise conservation center. Running dry, and wildlife officials plan to close the facility and euthanize hundreds of tortoises that were once classified as endangered and are currently considered threatened. The desert tortoise can be found in the southwestern United States, but its population has been dwindling. In some areas, the tortoise population has decreased by 90% since the 1980s, and in the Mojave Desert, the population is considered threatened. It is illegal to touch, harm, or harass these animals, and the Desert Tortoise Conservation Center has tried to increase their population ever since they were added to the endangered species list in 1990. Still, only 100,000 desert tortoises are estimated to remain in the wild. Federal funds, unfortunately, are running dry at the Las Vegas Valley facility, so it'll shut its doors in 2014, and the tortoises deemed feeble to survive in the wild will be set free. Many of the tortoises at the center were formerly kept as pets and are unable to survive in the desert. There was a huge seizing of 367 dogs last week in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia, what is believed to be the second largest dog fighting raid in U.S. history. And after a three-year investigation initiated by the Auburn Police, 13 search warrants were executed Friday morning, August 23rd, through Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, and Texas. 10 suspects were arrested and indicted on felony drug fighting charges. Federal and local officials seized firearms, drugs, as well as $500,000 in cash from dogfighting, gambling activities that took place over the course of the investigation. Anyway, rough situation. On a happier note and a more local note, tomorrow, Thursday, the August 29th, there's a yappy hour being presented by Dogma, a pet rescue. That's going to happen again tomorrow, the 29th, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Joya. Fabulous Martini Bar in Riverview. And there'll be music, martinis, door prizes, and more. And the benefits, the proceeds will benefit Dogma Rescue. So you can search for them on that. Want to find out more? And that's time of the year, kind of when a lot of shelters and others are trying to really, really urge people to make adoptions. So among the things along those lines, the Humane Society of Pinellas is really urging that. And can't tell you their thing, but basically there's a name your own adoption price going on. And by 4 p.m. Saturday of this weekend, they want every adoptable pet in a home. And we'll work with you in pretty much every way possible to make that happen. So you can go to HumaneSocietyOfPinellas.org to view the adoptable pets and find out more about that. We're going to have to hold off on the other stuff till next week. So, all right, so let's play Name That Animal Tune. You do not need to be a WNF member to win. There'll be a prize, the debut CD by Wild Flag and the band. That's the band led by Carrie Brownstein of Sleater Kenny and Portlandia fame. So let's see if you can name this animal tune. 813-239-9663. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals. All right, we'll take that off the air. We have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, September 4th, when my guest will be Nikki McQueen, Vice President of Anderson McQueen Funeral Homes and Cremation Tribute Center. A pet funeral director will be speaking on a forum at Stetson College of Law Center here in Tampa on September 7th, pegged to National Pet Memorial Day. So I hope you'll join us for that. Otherwise, we're at TalkingAnimals.net, Facebook page, Twitter feed, all kinds of information, archives of every show we've done over 10-plus years and more. So I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Our thanks to Dr. D. Borsma and Ted Koran for joining us today on Talking Animals. Stay tuned for Alternative Radio NPR News headlines coming before that. Take care. WNF Tampa.